This is the Freedom Files, a Pursuit of Justice podcast focusing on a wide range of issues involving liberty and justice for people with disabilities, whether they are young adults or seniors or any age in between. Your host is attorney Thomas F. Coleman. Executive Director and Legal Director of Spectrum Institute. And with me today, I have John DiPietro, who's sitting across from me. He's not on camera. And John is an attorney and a research associate with the Funding and Fees Review Project, which I'll describe in a moment. And then I have Barbara Buckley with me. Barbara, maybe you could introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm the Executive Director of Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, which is in Clark County, Nevada, home to Las Vegas.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and we really appreciate you giving us your time. John and I have been working together as the volunteer staff people for this funding and fees review project. And what it's about, it's focusing on California and probate conservatorships involving adults with various cognitive and communication disabilities. And what I've come to see is this situation with respect to attorney's fees. I call it a fee for all. And so it started out that the project was going to review the assessment of fees against the estates of and the assets of conservatees and proposed conservatees to pay not only for the attorneys who represent them, appointed to represent them, but also to pay for attorneys for any number of other parties, conservators, temporary conservators, petitioners, objectors, and so on. And what we found is that it's all done ad hoc, and people's estates are just being drained by these fees and so on. So it started out with that, but then we expanded it to the use of public funds to provide legal services to indigents in these cases. And we thought if we're going to look at legal services, not only from the financial point of view, but also from the quality of them, we should look at both types, the indigents and those with assets. And so we're looking at the use of public funds to fund public defenders in the counties where public defenders offices do this, or contract public defenders, or private attorneys who are appointed by the court. And so those are the two aspects. We're reaching out to you, Barbara, because it seems like you kind of are a hybrid where you're dealing with people with or without assets. And you know, you can explain all of it to us, how it works. But John and I have looked at a number of models, public defender model, court-appointed attorney model, other possible models from like the child welfare system, and, you know, other types of legal representation. And so far, we have not come up with anything, any existing program that's providing quality or at least passable, you know, in a pass fail, we want it to be in the pass arena. We'd like it to be B plus or higher if we could, but we haven't found anything that's providing the quality of services or that has performance standards or monitoring or quality assurance, or it's all ad hoc and just a mishmash. So what I'd like to do is open this up for you to give us some background about what your legal aid center, the types of representation that you provide in adult guardianships, both for people with or without assets. And as I mentioned in an email with some questions to you, we're interested in how attorneys are recruited and what your philosophy is and what type of training they receive and are there performance standards? Is there any monitoring? You know, how do you handle the cases where people do have assets? And Have you made a difference? Have you been able to track anything in terms of changes to the system or these cases? And also, once an order is entered for a guardianship, do you just kind of like disappear then? Or are you on the case for the life of the case? Or do you reappear when there's a need? And how would you know there's a need? So those are the types of issues. And I'd like to just turn it over to you for you to share, you know, in any of those dimensions, in whatever way it seems to come out naturally for you.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to talk about something that I'm very passionate about. So we created our guardianship unit at Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada in the aftermath of a very chilling scandal where we had individuals who were placed under guardianship, sometimes without even being served with the petition, without knowing about it, and suddenly being assessed unbelievable fees and sometimes just robbed of their life savings. Some were forcibly removed from their homes that they cherished, only to see their beloved home sold, their beloved, you know, belongings, family treasures put out on the street or sold in a yard sale until all of their assets were gone. Just as bad was their treatment, right? They were treated not like a human being, but someone to be taken advantage of. And it was pretty shocking and pretty scandalous. And it ultimately resulted in a commission being formed to look at the prospect, to look at the situation. And a few things resulted. One was a Bill of Rights for proposed protected persons and protected persons, which I had the honor to write. The right to counsel, which I had the honor to help set up, and a number of other statutory changes, including the establishment of a guardianship compliance office to keep another eye out on the money. So fast forward to today. In setting up our program, we set it up very similar to our Child Welfare Children's Attorneys Project. And that is, first of all, with our model of representation. We represent the protected person, their legal rights. Even if someone can't communicate with you, they have legal rights to be treated with dignity and respect, to not be overcharged, to be in the least restrictive environment, which means they're home if they can afford home health care. They are the center of the action, not the guardian or the guardian's attorneys. So that was our first step, our philosophy. Our model is a staff attorney model. So what we do is we recruit people, and what we're looking for are people who are the best and brightest, who believe in the mission, who believe that individuals with disabilities or our elderly should be treated with dignity and respect, and who aren't going to just be fleeced and put aside because they may be losing a step. So our attorneys, some are young, idealistic, right out of law school. They don't want to work for corporate America. They want to change the world. Some are really experienced practitioners who can't do what they're doing one more day, right?
Right.
They are so sick of lacking any sort of meaning in their world, in their professional life. So that's who we recruit. We promise them, hey, we cannot match salaries in the private sector, but you'll never work in a better place and your work will never be more meaningful. On top of that, we add a pro bono program where we recruit volunteers to help. So currently in our children's program, we have 29 attorneys and 350 pro bono volunteers. We represent about 6,000 abused kids a year. In our guardianship program, we haven't fully implemented our pro bono portion of it yet. And that's because we wanted enough time to make sure all of our staff attorneys were experts so they could serve as mentors to volunteer attorneys. So as I mentioned, we have 18 attorneys in our guardianship program now, 14 represent adults, and 4 are representing minors. That part of the program just began in 2020. To give you some idea of volume, in 2020, we opened up 710 new adult cases, closed 652, and we have 1,700 active cases. So what do our attorneys do? We get appointed a case and we go out to meet with a protected person. COVID stopped that a bit. In our normal world, we go to where the client is. We want to pick up nonverbal cues, plus we want to see, you know, where the person is at. And then we interview the client. We ask them, what do you want? What do you think is going on? Have you seen a petition? And of course, the answers vary depending on the person's capacity. Sometimes it'll be a client who's in the hospital and say, I don't know who the hell filed this guardianship petition against me. It's who? Rita? My next door neighbor? Are you kidding me? I don't even like her. Or it may be a daughter of an ailing mom who has dementia, right? So the situations vary. We basically take every case, means, no means, we take it. Now, once we get into the case, if we see there's a lawyer that has represented that family for a long time, there's no issues, we'll get off the case. But in the very beginning, we often can't tell whether there's money or not. And we don't get off if there's money, because as one really great court administrator told me here in Clark County, in cases involving money, we want you on the case because we know you're honest and mission focused and you're not charging the estate. Your goal isn't to drag out this case. Your goal is to preserve the estate and put the protected person's rights first and foremost. So we're taking every case. We track outcomes. So for every case closed, we look at, you know, what happened. So in 2020, we closed 652 adult guardianship cases. Guardianship was denied or avoided in 25% of those. Another 23% were terminated for cause after the guardianship was granted because either the person recovered or the guardianship was no longer needed. So we keep track, we keep statistical outcomes for every case. Our lawyers are supervised by a lead attorney. So every case is examined upon closing. There's weekly meetings as they brainstorm approaches for clients. They may say, oh my gosh, what about this attorney A? I can't believe their hourly fee they're trying to assess against all the estates. We need to come up with a battle plan against them, right? Because they're overcharging. But every time an attorney we feel charges something that is not reasonable, or not just in light of the size of the estate, we file an objection. So, you know, our clients can be anywhere from, we represented 600 clients between 18 and 30, and 150 clients, 90 plus, right? So it's a large scale of clients. So maybe I'll just stop there. And, you know, let you ask any questions that you'd like about the program.
Okay. First of all, I'm just blown away. I'm just in awe of what you've been able to accomplish there. And the contrast of what you're doing with what's happening, not only in California, but around the country. So, you know, congratulations on that. In terms of the denied or avoided 25%, is that sometimes because there's like another support system in place that you point out? And so it's either like supported decision-making, let's call it that, you know, whether it's formal or informal. And how do you, on a case, is it just the attorney or do you have an investigator, a social worker? Is there like a multidisciplinary or a team approach to working up a case?
Yeah, so we have two advocates who work alongside the attorneys, but mostly it's the attorney that is actually working the case. And yes, you're right. Sometimes we go out and let's say it's a young adult with a disability. And we meet the young adult and they say, I love my mom, but I don't want her to be my guardian. And we talk to the mom and we say, do you know there's supportive decision making? There's different instruments beyond guardianship that are less restrictive. And oftentimes the mom will say, I had no idea.
Right.
And so that's it. The case is resolved. Sometimes the child, the young adult, and that the mom still says, no, I want guardianship, and we'll go forward and the case will get dismissed.
Yeah. Okay.
So it depends, but sometimes that's the case. And sometimes the person doesn't need a guardian. That's just, they don't need one.
Right. Right.
And we have kind of these trends, like for a while we had hospitals filing for guardianships. Like they were afraid to just discharge someone, maybe afraid of liability. Well, and the people they picked were living on their own just fine.
Yeah.
And so we fought every single one of those and typically won.
So maybe that's happening less frequently now?
It is happening less frequently. And that's always your goal, right? Put yourself out of a job.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Do you ever, what percentage of your cases go to a contested hearing? Is it a small number or a small percentage or 10%, 15%, or?
I would say about 10 to 15% of our cases are really contentious.
Okay.
And, you know, the rest, the person wants a guardian,
it's
a beloved family member, a bond's put in place, or the money's restricted, and there's just no issue.
Right. Okay. And in terms of the life of the case, are you on it somebody could be in a guardianship for 20 years. Are you on it as the attorney of record for that case for the 20 years?
Yes.
Okay.
We debated that when we set up the program, but we were concerned if we got off, could mischief happen?
Absolutely.
And so we decided to stay on. And so what we do is it's every 6 months at least, we go visit the client, see how they're doing. And then of course, every 12 months, there's the annual report, which is where you make sure that money is being spent in accordance with the plan and wisely. But we chose to stay on.
Okay, that's great. It reminds me of the public defenders. I've checked with many of the offices and they're on for the life of the case. But that, I think, it has a technical meaning, and in practicality, I don't think it really, we're going to be digging into that to really find out what's going on, because I think that there's nothing happening. It's just a technical, if the person calls us, we'll help them. Well, how is the person going to call, right? So the other, let's see, are there ever any jury trials? Is that permitted in Nevada?
No, all of them are bench trials.
Okay.
And most of them are, front end loaded, meaning these cases are most of the time, right? Most of the work is done in the beginning.
Right.
Is guardianship granted or not?
Okay. Are there, do you file appeals ever?
Yes. Yes.
And then you, do you represent them on appeal or does somebody else get appointed to do the appeal?
No, we stay on. Sometimes we'll associate in an experienced appellate lawyer pro bono to assist, especially if our attorneys are really busy. But we have, we're appealing some of the fee cases.
Oh, good.
Where we believe that excessive fees were awarded.
Okay. So let's see here. The training programs, I've seen some of your materials and they look excellent. So do you have, is the training just for the new attorneys coming on board or do you have in-service training as well? How does that work?
Yeah, we have in-service training as well. Our staff is always on the lookout for training on how to interview someone with diminished capacity. Anything on alternatives to guardianship, ABA trainings. And so they attend quite a few.
Okay. Are the attorneys completely autonomous from the judges who hear the cases? Does a judge blackball somebody from his or her courtroom? Does a judge have any say about which attorney gets assigned to a specific case? Are the judges now just deciding cases and they have no control over the performance of the attorneys other than the normal, you know, what's happening in my courtroom? A judge obviously can behavior can be regulated.
Right. No, our judges do not choose which attorney goes on a case or anything, you know, any of those issues. When a case is filed, we get the referral, we get the notice, and we file a notice of appearance. And what this system allows is it prevents judges from being really in the improper position of referring a case to a lawyer, right? Or having it be kind of seen as a closed system, which can, it's too comfortable and it can kind of, you can have favorites and then they're not going to turn down their fees.
Right, right.
The judges need to be impartial arbiters. That is what they are should be good at, right?
Yeah.
And that is the ideal system. They should not be too close and referring back and forth certain attorneys for these cases.
Now, originally, was there some hesitancy by the judges or concern when you came on board? And what is their attitude now about the role that you play in the system there?
Well, the entire system was restructured after the scandal. And I think by and large, the judges were really pleased that we were tasked with this. Our Children's Attorneys Project, which we established in 1999, is so well respected. We won the national award for the best children's office, and our judiciary knows that. And they thought, wow, this is what we're going to get for guardianship too.
Okay.
So basically, you know, I think they were all very pleased that we agreed to take on this challenge. Now, some of the lawyers who are getting lots of money from protected people for a really long time from estates, they were not so happy to see a lot of unearned income no longer going their way.
Right. Okay. And how is your work funded? Where are there multiple sources of funding or how, you know, obviously it costs money to do what you're doing. So where does it come from?
So in the, during the commission that was created following the scandal, it was recommended that a fee be introduced by the legislature. So the Nevada legislature introduced a $3 fee on recording of documents to fund this work. And so, you know, we also get additional, you know, kind of charitable donations to support our work, but most of it comes from that recording fee.
And that is sufficient to enable you to do what you do.
Yes.
It's amazing. I mean, it seems like so, you know, minimal in terms of any burden on anyone, you know, right. $3, you know, is $3 per recording?
Yes.
Of anything at all.
Of a document with the county. Okay. Yeah, to us, it was a minimal burden to create an innovative solution to a huge problem. And I think it's so important to not have the attorney for the protected person getting paid from the estate.
Right.
Because we're able to say to everyone, look, we have no skin in this game, but we are going to tell the judge that you are the one dragging this out. And our client does not want the two of you fighting. So could we just resolve this?
Right.
And it's able to inject just a different dynamic in some of these proceedings.
One of the things I also like about what you do is that I assume that you do not handle petitions for petitioners. You're on the defense side. What we have here in California, especially where in the cases that they're not indigent, is that one day an attorney might be court-appointed counsel for the proposed conservatee, and the next day they're the attorney for the petitioner, and the next day they're the attorney for the conservator or temporary conservator. And so there's nobody wants to push back against their colleagues, because then they'll get the pushback. So it's always just kind of go along to get along. And so having people who are, you know, it's like having a public defender isn't the public defender one day and a prosecutor the next.
Right.
You know what lane you're in, you know what you're supposed to do.
Right.
You're not trying to make friends other than just normal collegiality and so on. So I like that part of your program.
Mm-hmm.
That you just do the one side.
Right.
When you have the 6 month and annual visits, is it the attorney that goes out to see the people?
Yes.
Well, these attorneys really get to know the people.
Yes. And that is the beauty of the program. Again, same with our children's program. Many times, you know, we know the person better than anyone in the, you know, the courtroom. We actually can say, well, you know, we were just talking about this case where we were assigned someone to represent, and, you know, they wanted to remove life support. And when our attorney was visiting the client, you know, he saw a, you know, Father's Day card, and he said, well, have we reached out? Obviously their children are visiting them. Have we discussed this with them? And it was like, oh, they have a child. The things that you're able to ascertain when you yourself visit and own the case, to me, is just, there is no substitute for it. And to be able to establish rapport with the client.
Yeah. So, and the other thing that I really understood and liked what you said about, even if the person is unable to communicate effectively, there's still a role for a court-appointed counsel to protect their rights. They've got rights, even if and so, for example, we had a bill introduced in February in California that we stopped it in its tracks, I think. But I wrote an op-ed calling it a Trojan horse. And because it basically said that if the attorney, court-appointed attorney, finds that the person cannot communicate, then they have a duty to notify the court, and then the court is supposed to take them off the case and put it in a guardian ad litem to do the best interest stuff. And so they have no advocacy attorney whatsoever. And then as far as the role of the attorney, it was just like, well, their role is the stated wishes of the client. And if the client can't state their wishes, there's no role. And I said, there's two roles. Yes, one is stated wishes, and that drives everything if the people are able to communicate. But if they're not, or simultaneously, there's the duty to defend their existing rights, the presumption of capacity, the burden of proof, who's the best person to be appointed conservator, least restrictive alternatives. All the procedural and substantive rights need to be defended regardless of whether the person can communicate. And I'm starting to have some success, but I'm having a hard time, you know, convincing people of this simultaneous role.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who don't understand it. So keep going, keep educating. I agree with you 1,000%. Someone does not lose their legal and constitutional rights just because they can't communicate.
Right, exactly.
Whether you are a 2-year-old child in the foster care system or a 90-year-old with dementia, you have legal and constitutional rights and you deserve an advocate.
Yeah, not a guardian ad litem.
Not a guardian
who's aligned with the judge, with the court, who's the eyes and the ears of the court and all of that. That if they want to do that too, that's a whole other issue.
Absolutely.
But an actual advocacy attorney,
yes,
in every case. And we have a bill that's gone through two committees in the Senate, and I think it's going to go through the legislature and be signed into law, SB 724, that will make appointment of counsel mandatory in all cases, will define the role of counsel as that of a zealous advocate.
Right.
And will require attorneys on appeal, because our appellate courts were just treating the people as if they were a piece of furniture or something, and they weren't appointing attorneys for them. Anyway, I don't want to, do you have anything, John?
I'm very happy.
He's all like,
I'm ecstatic.
clapping and excited about this. So I think that, you know, we've been on for about a half hour here, and I think that this is a good place to bring it to an end. I tell you that I know that we will be promoting your model as the model for California, and whether each county has it, or maybe there's a state entity for, or maybe regional in some of the counties, that, you know, we'll figure out a way to package it. But it's the only model of its kind that, you know, all the boxes are checked. You know, honesty, integrity, no conflict of interest, client-oriented, trying to put yourself out of business, terminate cases when possible, not being obstinate just for the sake of it, just only opposing when it's, you know, called for. I mean, all of the boxes are checked on what an ideal system would be. So anyway, however it came to be that they chose you, or you chose to be the one to do this, we really, really applaud you and thank you for spending the time with us.
This concludes today's episode of the Freedom Files, a Pursuit of Justice podcast. For more information, visit the show's website at pursuitofjusticepodcast.com. The Freedom Files is produced and hosted by Thomas F. Coleman. Artistic and technical advice from Adam Soch. Promotional advice from Diane Coleman Rogers and Sherry Kellogg. The podcast is a collaboration of Spectrum Institute and the Law Office of Thomas F. Coleman.